Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Conversations. We're starting a little late today because we had some sound connection problems, but we've resolved them, and we're going to go ahead with the rest of the hour and entertain you with our usual spirited discussions. Food Conversations is a program about everything to do with food, starting with planting seeds, and then on to growing, harvesting, distributing, and, of course, eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Before we continue, I'd like to acknowledge we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for all of us. Now today, I'm very pleased to welcome Sue Moore, to the studio. She's in her home on Zoom, as usual, and we're here. And Sue is the owner of Sudoa Farm, and we'll explain what that title means later on, but Sue has become kind of a fixture in the world of food and agriculture in the Shoe Swap, both as a producer and as a mentor for anyone who wants to grow healthy and nutritious food. Welcome, Sue, to Food Conversations.
Well, thank you, Warren.
Was delighted to have you here, even though it was a complicated process sound-wise this morning, but we're on and running. Now, we're going to talk today about the long and winding road. Sorry, I had to use a Beatles reference here, Sue, because you're originally from England. To Sue and followers since she was born just a few years ago in Neasden, which at the time was a small town northwest of London, England. We'll have Sue back in a few weeks to talk about many of the practical ways to help plant food plants to grow, which she's picked up over a lifetime of growing plants. And when I say lifetime, I mean a lifetime. Now, Neasden, Sue, I looked it up on the map and Wikipedia, the ultimate source of information. It was originally a small hamlet outside London. When you were growing up, it was still sort of outside London. But right next to this giant underground, London Underground rail yard where they've sort of refurbished the vehicles and wound them up and whatever. But you had a garden in the rail yard, I mean, adjacent to the rail yard. That was your first garden.
Yes. With from the age of about five, I started going to an allotment, which was on the side of the rail yard.
An allotment was a public space that you had access to use for your garden, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we had everyone got a quarter of an acre,
which is a pretty good chunk of land, actually, when you're growing veggies. Yes. And those veggies were the veggies you ate at home.
Absolutely. After the war, there was still quite a bit of rationing. So without those veggies, we would have been, quite deprived.
So from your point of view as a young girl, there was, and a young person in Britain, you were seeing the beginning of the changing of the food system from these wartime years where rationing was the order of the day, where food was not, well, people must have grown some food during the war as well, right? In gardens.
During the war, you by law, you had to grow your own food. The victory gardens were enforced.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So but this was now food for satisfaction in the 50s, early 50s.
Absolutely.
So what did you guys grow? What was on the menu from the garden, the family garden?
Well, there were a lot of vegetables that I'd never heard of until I came to Canada. But we used to grow tomatoes, cabbages, lettuce, parsnips, lots of parsnips, onions, and Brussels sprouts.
So are there any of those foods that you don't like to eat anymore because you had so many of them when you were a kid?
No, I could never get enough food.
Food is good. Food is always good.
Food is great.
Your father was the one who took you to the allotment plot. Your mother, though, was kind of a role model you described her as a very strong person. What was her strength? What made her that kind of a person? What were qualities like that?
She just managed everything. She was a very solid, practical person, and if there was if there was any issues, she worked out how to solve them, not just for herself, but for her neighbors as well. She was a great community-minded, kind of pillar of the community.
Hmm. The you also had an uncle who had an allotment, and I think he was the one who exposed you first to yellow tomatoes.
Yellow tomatoes, yes. Yes, my uncle Sid was a railway worker, and it was actually through him that we got the allotment. He had an allotment with Dad, and he grew quite a few vegetables that I'd never heard of, but we didn't really get to eat them that much. He was pretty stingy with his yellow tomatoes.
You saw them, but you did not ingest them.
Yes, I wouldn't dare to pick one.
Absolutely not. Now, there was one experience you had when your father was planting carrots, and he used something in the planting process that he wouldn't let you come near. Talk about that.
Yes, I probably was a wee bit older, maybe 8 or 10, and I was helping him seed the garden, and I wanted to put the carrots in, and he wouldn't let me because he put this substance in with the carrot seed, and I really think it was diazinon. It was a chemical to kill the carrot rust fly. And he wouldn't let me touch it. He put it on a top shelf. He wouldn't let me anywhere near it because it was poison. And I thought to myself, why are we putting poison in the ground? Why would I eat these carrots if they're going to be poisoned?
Absolutely. And that stuck with you. That memory stuck with you.
It did. It stuck with me. It wasn't something I really dwelt on at the time, but when I came to growing my own gardens later in life, it was like, I'm never going to put poison in the ground.
I'm very glad to hear that. I'm very glad to hear that, Sue. So you got a few jobs. You delivered newspapers. You worked at Woolworths. And you started to become another theme in your life, as we were talking the other day, was being a woman and how that hamstrings you when it comes to advancement in so many areas in society.
I was in the education system in England at the time when women were still expected to be, nurses and secretaries, the occasional teacher maybe.
And homemakers.
Yeah, absolutely. I took home ec. I wasn't allowed to take woodwork. I wasn't allowed to take physics. It was very unsatisfying experience going to school, and I quit school when I was 15 or 16.
You described at that point in time your view of England was a small country with small people with small minds. Diminution on all sides. That's what it felt like, though, for you. You were surrounded by restrictions because you were a woman, a girl.
Very, very restrictive, and there was so much that I felt that I wasn't allowed to do. So it was even a fight to get my father to let me drive a car.
Oh, dear me. That sounds like Saudi Arabia all over again. So you took an escape route that was available to a young woman, and that is you got married to somebody who didn't live in England.
That's correct.
I must admit that is a very effective method. It's practical. No animals are killed in the process of transferring one country to another. That was 1969. You and your husband-to-be, I guess you must have been husband and wife at that point, officially, because that would have been considered necessary, traveled around Europe for a bit, and then you moved to Canada.
Yes, we moved to Canada. We flew over to Montreal. We caught the train from Montreal to Vancouver with the very last of the money that we had, and ended up at my ex-husband now, at his family home in Burnaby, and stayed with his parents for a few days.
Tell our listeners about Saskatchewan as you trained through Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan, what was Saskatchewan like when you were on the train?
I remember being disappointed because I was going to sleep. Night was coming on just as we entered Saskatchewan, and I really wanted to see this big piece of flat land. And then I remember waking up in the morning and seeing this big piece of flat land and thinking that we'd been stuck in a siding overnight.
That was Saskatchewan. No, Saskatchewan goes on forever. The prairies go on forever.
It was an amazing trip, and it was something that I'll remember forever.
You were coming from a highly populated, London's right next door to where you grew up, and there were people around everywhere. And suddenly you're in a country that goes on forever, and there's vast amounts of space where nobody seems to be there. Rupert Brooke, the poet, was astonished by this, and he was intimidated. He went back to England because he couldn't stand the spaciousness of Canada. But that entranced you.
Oh, it did. It did, absolutely. And you know, arriving at the station in Vancouver, getting picked up by these new parents that I'd gotten through my marriage, and driving through Vancouver and seeing these beautiful houses, but never a garden, never a vegetable, very few flowers. It was mind-blowing, actually.
Suddenly you saw people who somehow were obtaining their food from anywhere but their own spot.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So just to compound the contrast between where you'd come from, the first place you moved to was Hatsik Prairie. Your husband was working for the Forest Service. You said it was about a vast total of 96 people in the town. Now, you'd been living next to an urban sprawl of millions, of 6 or 7 or 8 million people, and here you are off in the sort of north shore of the Fraser River, kind of in the countryside, with less than 100 compatriots living around you. What was that like? That must have been extraordinary.
It was just part of this new experience. It was very relaxing in a lot of ways. I was not a conventional woman. I didn't wear makeup. I didn't wear nylons. I didn't wear the high heels. And it was just such a relief to be around all these people who were so similar to me.
It's interesting. You met Lily, who is a World War I war bride, not a World War II war bride, who talked to you things about growing things, and also talked to you about the frustrations of being a woman, and that it was natural to feel that way.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. She was a wonderful woman, and I think she was very happy to have me as an English person living on her property. She felt she could talk to me, and she did. She expressed a lot of frustration at not being able to do things, and actually ending up as a British woman living in Canada, married to a Swedish man, and only able to get a Swedish passport.
Dear me, we males have a lot to account for. I mean, there's some good uns, but by golly, sometimes we get stuck in our in our way of doing things. So you had a veggie garden there as well, and pretty much everywhere you've lived, there's been a garden. When you saw those houses in Vancouver, you said, well, that's not for me. I'm not going to be doing that.
No. No, they must have had gardens around the back, for goodness sake.
Hidden gardens. Yes, came out at night and plowed the fields. So you next move on to Powell River for 3 years. Now that's even more remote. You're you probably at that time could only get in by boat, right?
And well, it was the double ferry.
Yeah.
Double ferries in, and we lived right in the town site of Powell River, under the smell and the smoke of the craft mill.
What a wonderful experience that was.
Yes, you had to watch what day you hung your laundry out, but it was nice, it was clean, it was open, there was lots of forest and beaches, and it was just a really nice open location, and I had both of my children there.
You had two sons. Sons. What are your sons' names? Because they move in and out all over the next half century.
John was my oldest son, and right. Daniel my younger.
And one of them is adventurous. Which is the adventurous one, and which is the more staid one?
I would say that Dan is the more adventurous one. He's he's traveled around the country, and he has he's ended up living in Nova Scotia with his partner on a farm.
Right.
And my other son is living in Sicamous on a farm with his wife.
Well, they picked up farming from you. Well, not that that would be difficult. It would be something they'd have to work very hard to not see, because it's been such a presence in your life. So, Powell River, you worked there as an accountant, you had your sons, and you had somebody come and do the housework, because that was the one thing you didn't want to do, and you were out in the garden with dirt under your fingernails.
Correct. Yes, and going to work, doing the garden, and spending time with the kids, that was my life at that point.
Then, you moved back to the Fraser Valley, which is where you've spent a very large part of your life in Canada. And this time it was to Mission in the mid-70s. And that was where you bought your first house.
Yes.
That was quite a step to take.
Yes. It's a small house on a double lot. And it was really... Yeah, it was. Houses were hard to find at that time, and we certainly couldn't afford a house any closer into Vancouver. But I was quite happy to live out further out.
I was remiss in not mentioning that you spent some time in Port McNeil, which was also a lovely place to live, and you also had a big garden there. So from Mission, you were starting to feel kind of constrained, and the feeling of being limited by the social role that was allowed for women was starting to really have an impact on you. But you, because you're a very industrious person, you actually started to take in foster children.
Yes.
And did that for about a decade or more.
Yeah. I had a number of foster children. The majority of them were youngsters. They were under four.
Right.
And I was reflecting on that after talking to you, and with one exception, they were all boys.
Well, boys are okay when they're very young.
boys are okay most of the time.
We just get more complicated as time goes by. that was also a point where there was a significant shift in your life, because your marriage came to an end, and you were very involved in women's issues at that point, working for the Vancouver Status of Women. And for the first time in your life, you moved in and you began a relationship with a woman, which allowed, you were immersed in women's issues, the women around you and the kind of work you're doing led to you having conversations. My impression, it would have been almost continuous about what women's role, women's rights, women's place, as it were, the experience of being a woman in society. That was a time of considerable ferment, it would seem to me, for you.
Yes, at that point in my life, I mean, I had never really been aware of family violence or the fact that women didn't earn as much as men, that they couldn't work because there was no childcare. I mean, I'd lived a lot of these experiences, certainly not domestic violence, I will add that. But living them and being aware of them are two different things.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
And I became aware of them and just found it was really frustrating and was really glad to be working in the women's movement and,
sure.
you know, to be part of a solution rather than part of a problem.
Now, at that time, Sue, in the 1980s, I guess early 1980s, there was a lot of funding for women's groups and for the women's movement, much of it from the federal government. And then it all dried up. There was a sort of a change of political climate and that kind of came to an end. And that was also a big time of transition for probably many people, but for the women's movement as well.
Yeah, many of us had to leave the work that we were doing and go into the regular workforce. At that time, I was lucky enough to get a job with a women's cooperative, Wild West, distributing organic produce.
Right.
And from there, I went also and worked with the East End Food Co-op.
Now, Wild West had one issue that was troubling for you, and that was that it was importing its food from California. It wasn't
the majority of its food. Yes, yeah. Like, I mean, carrots. For goodness sake, we could grow carrots in BC, and here they were coming in from California.
Yeah,
so carrots, lettuce. Of course, there's some things, you know, the oranges and the bananas. We needed to import, but. Not those basics.
And you started you also started to broaden your perspective a little bit into the sort of social role of women and the notion that one thing you said to me that struck me was that asking for equal pay for equal work isn't all that helpful if there are no services to support some of the other things that women and other people have to do.
Yeah, I think that's the time when my concern for the environment was parallel to my concern for women. Like, if women didn't have the services, they couldn't work. But if they didn't have the clean air and the good food, they couldn't live.
Yes. Yes.
And somehow those basics became more important to me over time because we needed to get those taken care of before we could take the next step.
It would be fair to say, would it not, that over the years these two themes, the notion of women taking on a more constructive and active role in society on the one hand, and then the need for us all to have healthy, abundant, available food that we have some control over, also being a theme. Like it seems to me those two themes run through much of what you've done over the years.
Yes, I seem to have had a path that I followed due to necessity and due to falling into it. It's really hard to say that you fall into farming, but in some ways that's exactly what I did.
Well,
like I saw a need and I tried to fill it rather than I wanted to be a farmer, so I went to agricultural college.
Yeah. Yes, and I think it's quite fascinating and important for listeners to know that your learning about food and farming and for that matter, women's rights, has all come from direct experience, not from an academic background. You've been on the ground growing food, and you've been living in relationships with the community of women as two essential features of your life for decades.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So to continue the travel log around the lower... the landscape of British Columbia. You and your partner Dorothy bought a first farm, 12 acres in Mission, not too far away from some of the other places you lived, and you built a house on it. House. You designed it and you built it. Now, I understand Dorothy's family were builders, so that they would come and give you some instructions, and then you'd go away with your hammers and your saws and your levels and your nails, and away you went.
Yes, that's correct. The other thing I'd do was I would truck into Vancouver and work at the East End Food Co-op and earn enough money to come home and buy the nails.
Yes, you always busy. Interestingly, again, looking at the position of women in society, you had to have your male neighbor come over when the inspector came around to look at your house as you were building it, to sort of give the male presence that gave the whole project sort of legitimacy in the eyes of the inspector.
Yes, after failing a couple of inspections and calling our neighbor over to discuss that with him, He was absolutely aghast that we didn't pass the inspections, and he insisted on coming over and being there when the inspector came, and with one exception, we passed every inspection after that.
That's a sorry comment on social mores, isn't it?
It really is.
Unusual. No. My wife tried to get a loan when she was a student at university, and the bank managers looked at her and said, "We don't give loans to young women." And she just kept on coming back until he knuckled down and actually gave her the money. East Vancouver Farmers Market, you were involved. Mary Forstbauer was one of your mentors. She was very prolific in multiple ways. She had 12 children, I believe.
Yes, she did. She was a wonderful woman. She was one of the first suppliers to Wild West with local organic produce. Mm-hmm. And the organic community got together and started an organic certification process.
Mm-hmm.
And through that process, we were able to legitimize selling the local organic produce.
Right. That was the BC Association for Regenerative Agriculture?
Yes, it was. It was. Wild West had a program of their own, but they were very happy to give it up to a more arm's length program as soon as they came on board.
And for the world to know, you were number 5 member in the organization. And the principles were no chemicals, untreated seeds, focus, and a big focus on soil improvement. In other words, get the soil right and then the plants will grow.
Exactly. And leave the land better than you found it.
Wonderful concept. And regenerative agriculture is now a buzzword these days, but here you are in 1985 already, 37 years ago, using the term and using it very pragmatically as well. Next move was away from Mission. There was some sort of social complications going on there, and one of your sons lived in Sycamose. Whoopsie daisy.
Well, you've missed a whole section of my life out there, yeah, Warren, because at that time my partner Dorothy was killed in a car accident.
Indeed, yes, indeed. Horrible situation.
And then a couple of years after that, another friend, Anne,
right,
and I got together.
Came into your life, yes.
And it was Anne and I who moved up to Notch Hill. But you're correct. I did have a son in Sycamose, and that's the main reason we came up into this part of the world.
Yeah, there were different parts of the province you were considering, but you came to the Notch Hill area and you and Anne sort of fell in love with the space. It seemed like you'd come to a new kind of heaven on earth.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Fabulous neighbors, fabulous location. And yes, great ability to grow food, fabulous land.
Yes, we're going to have to truncate some of our content today. because of the late start. But I'm going to just rattle off a few names, and you can give me some short snappers, as they used to say on Reach for the Top. Community Congress for Economic Change changed your life.
They were the credit union in Vancouver who supported me because they knew me.
Indeed.
And without any financial foundation whatsoever, gave me a wonderful financial mortgage support when various deals in my life fell through.
And you bank with them to this day?
I do.
Well, for all the good they did for you, I can see why you would consider doing that. But you found land in the Notch Hill area. You talked to all the neighbors and found out where the best soil was, and you set up your farm, 126 acres, Notch Hill. The full name is the Notch Hill Farm and... Okay, you give me the full name because I have it here.
We always operated under the name Pseudo A Farm, and then we also operated under the name Notch Hill Organic Farm and Nursery.
And Pseudo A was your first two initials of your name, and then Dorothy's first initials were of her name, and then Anne's letter.
And then Anne, yes.
So it was a very personal kind of connection. The winter of 1986 was a big turning point. The barn collapsed, the snow fell, and the provincial emergency program came and rescued you and saved your bacon.
That's right. That actually was 96, and yes, that was the year that we had moved up into the area, and we'd had all these financial issues. And quite honestly, without that barn falling down, I don't know what would have happened to us.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there today, but we'll be talking to Sue again about growing things because she's a wealth of knowledge about that. She's now living in Salmon Arm. The 126 acres have been sold, but she's very busy in the farm and agriculture and growing community, and you're going to hear a lot from her in the future that will be very down to earth, as they say. Sue, thank you very much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Warren.